it's Diane. On my mind, the rise of QAnon. It started as a conspiracy theory posted in online message boards. Now, the followers of Q have become a visible presence at Trump rallies and a growing influence within the Republican Party. Their core belief is that powerful elites control the government and are engaged in all sorts of corrupt activity, including the secret torture of children. Donald Trump, meanwhile, has been delivered to the presidency, they believe, to overthrow the cabal. Adrian LaFrance is executive editor of The Atlantic. She's been following the growth of QAnon and wrote about it in a recent article titled The Prophecies of Q. She joined me Tuesday morning. Adrian, define for us QAnon.
So this is always a bit complicated because it's this sprawling conspiracy theory, but the core premise is that Q is a mysterious figure with high-level military intelligence, and through that access knows that there are high-profile Democrats secretly torturing children and that Donald Trump is working to save them. That is the idea.
Wow.
Wow, I was right.
Do you have any thoughts as to who Q might be? Some have speculated it could be the president himself.
I have heard that theory. I don't think that it's the president. And I do wonder who Q is. In fact, in reporting the piece that I wrote for The Atlantic, my original goal was to find out Q's identity. And unfortunately, I failed at that. But along the way, I heard a lot of different and some more than compelling than other theories. I don't know. I think the places I'd look are, of course, where Q shows up. So a lot of people look at the site where these Q drops or the clues that this person or people post. The owner and administrator of that site have said that they are not Q and they don't know Q's identity, but a lot of people speculate about that. And then I think you look at the people who have built their own fame off of QAnon. And there are various theories about whether those people, sort of the Q influencers, whether anyone there has special knowledge or is involved. There's also this question of foreign influence. And I don't have any evidence that, you know, Q is tied to Russia or originated with Russia, for example. But we know that there is evidence that Russia makes good use of various channels to push QAnon misinformation. So those are a few of the theories that come up frequently, but I can't say with confidence that I know who Q is.
Now, you started your piece in the June edition of The Atlantic with Pizzagate. Tell me what happened then.
Well, Pizzagate refers to a conspiracy theory that originated right around this time in the last presidential election. And so, if you'll recall, there was this very high profile hacking of private emails. John Podesta, then the campaign chair for Hillary Clinton, who was then the presidential candidate, his emails were hacked and made searchable online. And through that, people found references to a pizza shop in Washington, D.C. called Comet Ping Pong. And because of that, there was this conspiracy theory that children were being abused at the pizza shop. This wasn't true, but it sort of spread like wildfire across the internet. And you could see all across the social web, more people sort of adding fuel to the fire and suggesting this was really happening in a way that people began to believe. And so when we talk about Pizzagate now, it's not just a reference to the conspiracy theory, but often a reference to this incident when a young man drove from North Carolina to Washington, showed up at this pizza place. It's a really sweet family pizzeria. There's ping pong tables in the back. I've been there many times. And he walked in with two loaded guns. People who were eating there, it's a Sunday afternoon. Families went running out. Employees went running out. He fired his weapon. Thankfully, no one was hurt, and eventually realized that the thing he came to find wasn't there. He believed that children were being abused at this pizza shop, when he showed up and realized that wasn't the case, he put down his weapons and surrendered to police. And so this moment is meaningful because the underlying narrative of Pizzagate was then borrowed to create QAnon later. But it also represented this moment when people realized, you know, more people realized that these conspiracy theories aren't just nonsense on the internet. They're seeping into the real world in really dangerous ways.
And in fact, working their way from the fringe right into the Republican Party.
Absolutely. I mean, you see that in a couple of ways. One, with the election victory of candidates for Congress who have openly supported QAnon. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia is probably the most well-known example. So you see that candidates are winning and supporting Q openly. You also see the president refusing to disavow this group. You see a mixed bag with other Republicans. Some high-profile Republicans will say very directly, this is nonsense, but many don't want to go near it. And that's because it is at its core a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. So there is a political risk calculus taking place here.
The candidate who, in fact, lost in Georgia, whose name is Dr. John Cowan, said QAnon is really the religion of Trump devotees.
I think that's right. I mean, it is a conspiracy theory that puts Trump at the center, that finds ways to justify his other character flaws and bad behavior, and that borrows really heavily from a lot of the language and worldviews of evangelical Christians. And so you have not just this religious quality because it's sort of this fervent devotion to Trump, but also an actual religious quality, the sort of spiritual nature of how its followers come together.
Where does the name QAnon come from?
So the name is a name that the person or people who drop these clues or Q drops created for themselves. And so On a site like 4chan, where QAnon first originated, it's called an image message board. And the way these sorts of sites work, it is a social platform, but not like Facebook or Twitter or, you know, the larger social sites make it really, really easy to publish. This is a little bit more convoluted and requires a bit more expertise, and it's totally anonymous. And so the people who use these sites refer to themselves as Anons. And so that's the Anon part. And then this person or people, whoever they are, chose the name Q, and in an early Q drop said that they chose it to reference a high level security clearance that they had. And so Q refers to this alleged high level security clearance, and Anon is just the anonymous user on this image message board.
Can you give me a time when Q became widespread? Was it the election of Donald Trump?
QAnon first appeared on the internet in October of 2017. So, you know, almost a full year after Trump's election. What I haven't been able to figure out is when it really tipped. You know, it's hard to say how big the movement is anyway because of its online nature. And it's also hard to say sort of when it reached escape velocity. The way that I might judge that is when it really tipped onto the mainstream social web. And so you would probably want to trace like when the biggest Q supporting groups appeared on Facebook and Reddit, which then famously later banned Q, or other places like that. But sometime probably closer to late 2017, 18 is when it really started to pick up speed, I think. But again, it's really hard to tell.
And what about other countries? Has it spread, for example, to Germany, or did it begin in Germany, spread to the U.S., or do we know for sure it began here?
We don't know for sure. And it's so interesting because it seems strange, at least to me, that other countries would be so seized by a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. Like it feels so American in nature. That being said, it's very, very popular elsewhere. You see in Australia and New Zealand and various countries in Europe. This is a global movement. But to answer your question, we don't know for sure that it originated in the United States.
How would you summarize the beliefs of those QAnon believers?
It's a very anti-establishment worldview, which is consistent with the Trump supporter worldview. So that makes sense in terms of a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. These are people who are very, in general, very distrustful of institutions. That includes scientific institutions, the free press, basically any institutions that Trump calls into question, which are many, are institutions that Q supporters would call into question. There's a lot of echoing of concepts like the quote-unquote deep state or the quote-unquote fake news. And so you see a lot of that with the Q crowd. There's also this strong sense of feeling like, you know, the country has moved in a direction that either leaves them behind or otherwise isn't the direction that they want it to go. When I talked to Q supporters, a refrain I heard all the time was sort of this wishing for the good old days. And yet when I asked sort of when was the country okay, like when were the good old days, they often didn't have a clear answer for that.
Can you give me a general profile of a Q supporter?
I can tell you the people I met. And again, this goes back to the online nature of it. We don't know concretely who is in the movement and who's a true believer versus who's just sort of treating this as fan fiction or playing along because they're a troll or whatever else.
But are you talking with them online or in person?
Well, so I'll tell you about the folks I met in person because that's the sort of most concrete portrait I could get, but it may be limited. The people I met, many of them at a Trump rally. So, you know, that's a subset, obviously, of Trump supporting Q followers. I do think the majority of them are Trump supporters. The people I talked to were disproportionately white and over 50. And a lot of the people I talked to were retired or recently retired. And the Q sort of became a hobby for them and a way to pass the time in retirement.
Pass the time? What do you mean by that, pass the time?
Well, so one of the big things that Q followers do in terms of how they express their support for Q is what they call research. And so this is a lot of spending time on YouTube accounts devoted to Q or within Facebook groups or other collections of Q supporters who are maybe unearthing a government document that they think proves some facet of this conspiracy theory. And so there's this strong sense of Q followers believing that sort of the world is lying to them and that they're being awakened to this new truth or this new reality and that they have to do the research in order to find out what's really true. The great contradiction here, of course, is that, you know, one woman I spoke with, for example, talked about how wonderful it was to have the internet and all of these various archives at her fingertips so she could be looking at, you know, the JFK files or that sort of thing. And I asked her, you know, well, you're saying you don't trust the government, but you're using government records isn't that sort of cherry picking or contradictory? And she didn't see it that way. It's just this very sort of willfully blind, do your own research, find the things that plug into this worldview and therefore their true attitude.
What kinds of clues do Q supporters see online that inform them?
There are all kinds of things. Everything from what color tie the president is wearing a certain day to which letters are capitalized in his tweets. I mean, any noise they will find a signal in.
Give me an example if you can.
Of course. So the tie example is a salient one. This was earlier on during the pandemic. President Trump held a press conference and wore a yellow tie. And shortly thereafter, all throughout Q groups online, there was this idea circulated that the yellow tie was a secret message that, in fact, there was no pandemic because yellow is a color that in maritime flags indicates an all clear. So once you sort of start looking into these things, like the rabbit hole is deep, I would say.
So they do not believe in the virus.
Well, it depends. So this is the trick with a sort of granddaddy of all conspiracy theories, is that it contains multiple other conspiracy theories that sort of splinter in all directions and sometimes contradict with each other. So some people who follow Q believe the virus is a hoax. Some people who follow Q believe that it's a bioweapon that was unleashed on the world by China working with the quote unquote deep state. Other people have other false theories about forced vaccination and Bill Gates and all manner of things. So there are lots of sort of subset pandemic conspiracy theories all within the Q universe.
And where did the pedophilia rumor begin, and how prevalent is it?
I would say it is one of the core and most important ideas of Q. And you could trace it, of course, to Pizzagate because it borrows directly from this earlier conspiracy theory. You can also trace it truly all the way back to antiquity. I mean, people, if you look at the history of conspiracy theories, you know, during the Crusades, people were blaming the Jews for all sorts of, you know, fabricated child sex abuse scandals that didn't happen either. And so we see this theme again and again in history coming up. You know, in the 80s, there was another conspiracy theory of this nature. And the important thing, I think, from the Q perspective is it gives the followers the ability to say, look, I know this sounds crazy, but if even one child is at risk, why wouldn't we look into it? And so it's sort of this, almost like this plausible deniability, or it raises the stakes to a level that they say they're forced to believe in it in a way.
So we have literally no idea how widespread this phenomenon is.
We can't say it concretely, but we have good evidence. And it's funny because I talked about this at length with the Atlantic's fact checkers when I was working on my big piece, because they really wanted me to be able to say with more, you know, in a more definitive way, how big it was. And so the way that we looked at it was, you know, the number of Facebook groups, the number of members in those groups, the uptick in traffic across various sites describing this, you know, the rapid growth of followers to various Q-focused YouTube channels. And so we tracked it across a number of metrics. But again, it's really, really what you can say is it has grown dramatically and grown rapidly, but it's very hard to come up with a concrete number.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Adrian LaFrance. Here is the rest of my conversation with Adrian LaFrance. She is executive editor of The Atlantic. Now, aside from Pizzagate, we've seen QAnon conspiracies translate into real-world action. California, Illinois, talk about those events.
Right. So there have been a number of really concerning incidents. In one case, a man parked an armored truck on the Hoover Dam and was making reference to QAnon. Also, the FBI has definitively said that they see conspiracy theory adherents as a domestic terror threat. And so, you know, for a long time, I think people have had an attitude that if something's just on the internet, it's not real. It's anonymous. It's just a joke. Sort of this separation between real life and internet life, when in reality, internet life is real life. And it's been that way for quite some time. And we're seeing that things that are damaging online are damaging offline as well.
Is there any reason to believe there is a connection between QAnon and the attempt to kidnap the governor of Michigan and, quote, take over the state?
I don't know that there is a connection, and that may just be that I haven't focused explicitly on that incident. But I think the connection you can make is at a moment of tremendous political division in the country, and a moment when trust in institutions that protect democracy has fallen so low. And there is a real threat of militant violence, in part because the president of the United States encourages it. And we've seen the direct connection to things he tweets and extremist groups being willing to respond. I mean, all of it sort of ladders up to the same tumultuous political and cultural moment we're in. So it's almost as though you don't need for someone to believe in Q explicitly. It's sort of just like in the water at this point, this worldview and propensity for violence and division that's really damaging.
Let's go back to the virus for a moment. The president himself became infected. As far as we know, he became infected with the virus. How do QAnon followers interpret that when, in fact, they deny that the virus exists?
Well, one of the big theories was that he wasn't, in fact, sick, but that he moved to a secure location so he could carry out these long-promised arrests of Hillary Clinton and other high-profile Democrats. Of course, that didn't happen. That wasn't true. But there is always, you know, rest assured with any news event, there is a Q theory and likely several Q theories to spring up and suggest some alternate version of real events.
And now the president is slamming Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci, his life, his family's life have all been threatened. He's got protection 24 hours a day. Is that part of QAnon, that those threats are now coming his way?
Absolutely. And again, this goes to sort of the Venn diagram overlap of pro-Trump and pro-Q is just, it's basically a circle. And so with Dr. Fauci, you saw early in the pandemic that there was a moment in a press conference where the president referred earnestly to the deep state, and Fauci was standing behind him, and you could sort of see him put his hand on his forehead and suppress a chuckle. And it was one of these moments that went viral online, and the Q crowd really seized on and didn't like, because it looked like he was sort of chuckling at the president for being, you know, using the language of conspiracy theories. And so since then, Q has been focused on Fauci, but also, to your point, as the president has openly attacked him as he did yesterday, that certainly adds fuel to the fire.
Wow. I mean, this most respected of all scientists who has been so clear and so direct and has been up to now on the stage with President Trump trying to help people understand this. Now the president has turned against him.
Well, I think that the president has a long history of turning against people who work closely with him. So there's the broad view. But there's also just this deep distrust for anyone who would disagree with him, but also this anti-establishment streak. You know, President Trump still describes himself as an outsider, despite occupying the most powerful office in the land. And his followers, and certainly Q followers, also have this deep distrust for the establishment. And that includes the scientific establishment, which is dangerous always, but particularly during a global pandemic.
Do you believe the president had the virus?
I do. You know, it's funny. When the news came out, I, like everyone else, was shocked and processing it because it was a huge story. And I had a fleeting moment of, I wonder if he's telling the truth, because we know how much President Trump lies to everyone. I also immediately then had this thought of, like, if you doubt everything, you risk being a conspiracy theorist yourself. And so, you know, I'm not sure what there would be for political gain. And I've read the arguments that, you know, he falsely claimed this so that he could detract from the coverage of his tax returns and those kinds of things. But a lot of people ask me sort of what you should say to a conspiracy theorist to help them be reasonable. And one of the things that experts suggest is to say, for this to be true, who would have to be in on it and how many? And I think you can apply that same rigor to the question of the president's illness. Sure, there have been cover-ups and there have been crazy things that have happened in government history, but the number of people who would have had to be in on this for it not to be true, it seems improbable to me.
What about social media companies, and what do you see as their responsibility? Some have already begun clamping down on QAnon.
I think it's a really complicated problem. I also think that social media companies have done far too little too late, and that it's not just Q. This is the latest sort of installment in a long history of failures in terms of things that damage democracy that social media companies enable. I think the problem is, you know, over time, I've thought a lot about the responsibility a social platform has to moderate harmful content. And thinking about it from a journalist perspective, or even from a business perspective, like if Facebook were a brick and mortar store and someone walked in and started shouting white nationalist viewpoints, wouldn't any reasonable business owner say, you have to leave the store? But historically, Facebook hasn't done that. And they've done it while also claiming that their platform is designed for a more open world and to promote community building, and using all of these really sort of like sunshine and rainbows ways of characterizing their impact on the world. At the same time, I sympathize with these platforms to some degree, maybe some small degree, because the scale of these platforms is just monumental. And this is where an analogy like, you know, newsrooms try to make sure that the material they publish is not harmful. Why couldn't a social platform? Well, a social platform like Facebook has 2 billion users. There's no newsroom on the planet that's that big. And so we're dealing with an informational ecosystem that is unprecedented in human nature, in human history. So I think there's been a lot of figuring it out as we go, and far too slowly, I suppose. And I should mention too, that even the recent crackdowns in many ways amount to whack-a-mole, and I'm not convinced that they'll work.
Is anything going to work?
I think it is a long game. I mean, I don't think QAnon is going anywhere. Certainly, humans are going to continue to be predisposed toward conspiracy thinking, some more than others. And so the way you counteract this is through the kinds of things that help make our democracy healthier. So, you know, how do we restore faith in the institutions that are good for us as a society? How do these social platforms actually tackle the harmful and misleading material on their sites? Yeah, I think it's really a question of how we restore democracy, and that's a huge, huge project.
Why do you think that this group has attracted so many evangelicals and deeply religious groups, considering Donald Trump's behavior right from the start?
Well, I think there are 2 ways that I look at this. One is that, and this was something that someone mentioned to me over the course of my reporting, this was a filmmaker who himself was raised in an evangelical home. And so he saw really clearly this parallel between Q, the sort of Q narrative and an evangelical worldview. And his view, which I found fascinating, was that QAnon offers evangelicals justification for Trump's flaws. So a Christian person could look at Trump and see someone who lies constantly, who has a history of infidelity, of various kinds of corruption, and they could say, these things are all bad, but because I believe in Q, I believe he's saving children. And that ultimately trumps these other flaws. And also that it's sort of cast in a preordained narrative that like he was chosen to be this sort of savior figure. So that's one way of looking at it, which I find compelling. And then the other is really just the way, I mean, if you look at what Q, sort of how people orient themselves around this conspiracy theory, it's not just the way someone might say, oh, I suspect the moon landing might have been faked, to use another conspiracy theory example, which is just like, yeah, you could think that, but it's not participatory. You're not joining together necessarily in a community in an ongoing way, sort of following this foundational text. Like the Q drops could be considered a foundational text to interpret. The communities of Q groups on Facebook are sort of coming together in worship in a way. And there's this preoccupation with the end times that really does echo a lot of sort of other worldviews that are preoccupied with the apocalypse. And so if you sort of map it against this worldview that you find in evangelicism, the parallels are really striking.
So what happens if Donald Trump loses the election? Is that the beginning of the apocalypse? Is it the end of the world? What happens?
So the apocalypse has almost started quite a few times, according to Q followers. This is also, there's a historic parallel in people who have been certain that the end times were going to arrive and then didn't, and they stayed committed to their views anyway. So we know that from religious history. I think that if he loses, Q followers will be emboldened because they'll say, look what happened to our guy. They're going to be following whatever he says. We see good evidence already that the president isn't going to graciously accept the outcome of a race if he loses. And so one can easily imagine how he'd stir up this crowd and sort of inspire them to rally around him in support and indignation. So to me, it's really clear that, you know, it's easy to see how Q could grow as a result of him losing.
Do you think there's any chance if Donald Trump is abandoned by his Republican supporters in Congress and elsewhere who are not members of Q, that might be the end of whatever kind of organization you can call it?
No, I don't. I mean, I certainly think it would be helpful for members of Congress to speak out against conspiracy theories. It would be the right thing to do. But this is where it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory, it's a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. And so it's really the only person, it's really up to Trump. If he were to say, this is nonsense, I don't believe it, I think that could create a small identity crisis for some followers. But quite frankly, I think what you'd see is Q people saying that that's a coded message and we know he's really with us. I mean, there is no reason or rationality in this movement.
Adrian, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Great to see you.
That was Adrian LaFrance, executive editor of The Atlantic. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening. Please take care of yourself and those around you. I'm Diane Rehm.